pretending to be American.
Pakistan has become jihad central.
And that he wanted to wage a jihad, or act of holy war, against civilians.
It's a hot war all the same, on a battlefield called jihad.com.
The jihad is not a holy war, it's a struggle. And love jihad is a struggle with the self.
So what I'm saying is that when this book changes the meaning of jihad into a pure, peaceful meaning, then and only then the Western countries should say jihad is only peaceful.
Those are some excerpts from a recent National Public Radio story on what does jihad really mean. The word is tossed around pretty easily, but getting a definition, a real definition, what it means to the average American politician may be something very different than what it means to the average Western Muslim, which may be very different from what it means from the average Muslim living in a Muslim country, much less his imam or his cleric. We're going to talk about the meaning of jihad during the next half hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. You can join us with questions or comments. We're coming to you live this Friday. It is the 18th of July, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-MYIE, or email us here in the studio with questions or comments, talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org. Dr. Adam Francisco is our guest. He's guest professor of historical theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's author of the forthcoming book, Luther and Islam. Dr. Francisco, welcome back.
Good afternoon, Todd.
The word jihad, we hear it all the time, and you can get as many different definitions for it as you can find people willing to step in front of a camera. In your reading of the Quran, is there any ambiguity as to the meaning of this word jihad?
There's no ambiguity. In fact, the scholarly consensus, both of Muslim and non-Muslim scholars who are, you know, specialists in Islam, all agree that jihad consists of a military action with the object of the expansion of Islam, and also, if need be, its defense. So it's very clear in the Quran that the term jihad itself comes from the Arabic jihada, which means to struggle. And usually in the Quran, what you see is the phrase jihada fi sabil Allah, to struggle, or one who struggles in the path of God, and that struggle is, historically and theologically, has always been defined as a physical struggle for the expansion and imposition of Islam.
All words really derive their true definitions and use from context. So let's talk about the context that not only the Quran but also the other holy writings of Islam lay out for this word, and begin, if you will, with the worldview that is Islam, how it views its place here in the world, the realm of war, the realm of Allah?
Yeah, ooh, that's a big question. Over just after Muhammad died, over, you know, just a few decades, some would say maybe a century or a little more, the Muslim scholars began to divide the world into two spheres. There was Darul Islam, which is the abode or sphere of Islam, and everything outside of that was defined as Darul Harb, or the abode of war. Some referred to it as Darul Jihad, the abode of jihad, into which the Darul Islam was to expand into. The Muslim worldview sees, if you look into the Quran, actually, it identifies Adam as the first human being. He is called a khalif, or a vice-regent of Allah, as is David, and by implication, all the other prophets in the Quran. And they're vice regents in that they are God's representative on earth, and they are on earth to ensure that human beings especially follow God's law, revealed law.
So
Allah's revealed law.
So basically, is it saying too much that and we're talking here about kind of classical teaching in Islam, from almost its very beginnings, if we're talking about after the death of Muhammad, that these two spheres, the sphere of war, the sphere of Islam, were thought of in geographical terms as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you look at the history of Islam, it is remarkable how quickly this domain of Islam expanded. Within 100 years of Muhammad's death, They had already made their way up into the, just past north, the Pyrenees Mountains in northern Spain, into France. They were just south of Paris. And in the eastern side, they had reached all the way to the Hindu Kush Mountains. So it's within 100 years, and it kept on expanding since then. It only turned around about the time just after the Reformation.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think one can't really understand Reformation history, this 16th century Western European religious movement that spearheaded by Luther and others, without understanding that the Turk, as they would have referred to the Islamic world, was knocking at Western Europe's door without without benevolent intention. How far had Islam expanded as, an empire by the time of the 16th century?
Yeah, well, during Luther's day, and about 200 years before, a new empire was born that sort of quickly replaced all the last vestiges of the old empires and really subsumed them. And it was known as the Ottoman Empire. It was based after 1453 in the old city of Constantinople, which is now called Istanbul. From there, the Ottomans were intent. They had always, scholars have found out that they've always had this, they always had this idea or this dream that they were destined to rule the world. And so they quickly, around 1517, 1518, they quickly were acquiring or trying to dominate classic Islamic territories. So, for example, the region of the Hejaz, where Mecca and Medina are located, Palestine, Syria, and North Africa. They had taken all that territory by 1518, and the Europeans at that time were engaged in a religious council, the Fifth Lateran Council, and they had decided at that council that they had better do something, so they decided to go on a crusade. And the plan was for a three-year crusade led by Maximilian I, the emperor at the time, where they would quickly, within 3 years, recover all the lands surrounding the Mediterranean. It went nowhere, though, because Maximilian died in 1519. When he died, the idea of a crusade and dealing decisively with the Ottoman Empire died with him. And so the Turks were able to rise up again, and they started expanding into southeastern Europe. By 1529, they're already at Vienna, outside the gates of Vienna. Thankfully, they were not successful in taking Vienna, but Ottoman scholars have, for the most part, agree that had they taken Vienna, they would have used it as a place to camp over the winter, because they weren't used to fighting during cold climates. And after the winter was over, they would seek the domination of Germany and make their way further west.
I mean, we could talk about couldas and might have beens, but had they succeeded in taking Vienna, a key city in their conquests, could they possibly have, barring any other circumstances, given us a Western Europe today that is Arabic-speaking and Islamic in its culture and religion?
Yeah, I think so, and there are many scholars who say that is the case, because if you look at Europe at the time, it's horribly divided. You have the Reformation going on, and there's all sorts of conflicts between the papacy and the states like France, and so they could not put up a unified front. In fact, that's why the Diet of Augsburg was called, to try to establish some sort of unity so that they could deal with the Turks. If you look at the preface to the Augsburg Confession, the first sentence mentions that the reason why it was called, to deal with the hereditary enemies of Christendom, that is the Turks.
Okay, so from both a Quranic context and from a historical context, we're dealing with the word jihad as literal, geographical, political, and physical warfare. How do we get to the point now today where if you talk to a Western Muslim, he will say, no, never understood it that way. It is my own personal spiritual struggle to be submissive or obedient to Allah.
I don't know. I think Islam here in America especially, and also I think to some extent Western Europe, is really trying to refashion itself. I don't know whether it's because they really believe that they can change their religion or if it's just an attempt to put a positive spin on a religion until, you know, they have their, they reach a majority of the, or at least a close to a majority of the population. It's very clear. There's, in fact, there's a great book by David Cook just called Understanding Jihad. He's just a sort of a neutral scholar from Rice University, and what he did was collected every tract, every theological tract written in classic Islamic languages, so Arabic, Persian, or Urdu, and looked at how it treated jihad. And he said, with one exception, all these tracts from the, you know, from the 8th century up until the 20th century all treated jihad as being primarily a physical exertion of force to expand Islam, or at least influence the world so that it would reflect Islamic norms. The one exception, oddly enough, was Ayatollah Khomeini. He wrote a book on jihad where he talks about what he called the greater jihad, which refers to this sort of internal struggle with sin. Western Muslims, and even some are saying now the U.S. government is trying to reinvent or give a new definition to the term jihad, which, fine, if Muslims really do accept this definition, that's fine for a while, but the real definition still remains and is still enshrined in their texts.
Dr. Evan Francisco is our guest. We're talking about jihad. We'll entertain your questions or your comments on jihad or Islam after the break. 1-877-623-MYIE. Talkback at issuesetc.org. 1-877-623-MYIE. Or talkback at issuesetc.org.
Ah, the sounds of rich liturgy and historic Christian worship. What a way to spend a Sunday morning. At Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt, Illinois, you'll find authentic Christianity as you hear the preaching of Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins. Come, join us Sunday mornings at 9 and Monday evenings at 7:30, and find out more about Trinity Lutheran Church, Millstadt, Illinois, at trinitymillstadt.org.
Issues Etc. is a team effort. Your phone calls, email, and snail mail help resurrect this worldwide outreach. Now we need your help to sustain Issues Etc. by making a gift to Lutheran Public Radio today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or by check, Lutheran Public Radio, Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. Help support Christ-centered, cross-focused talk radio for the thinking Christian.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Pro-abortion advocates insist they only want women to have a choice, but an uninformed choice is no choice at all. For many women in America, the right to know the truth about abortion is denied to them because abortionists are not required to provide them with vital information, such as the fact that her unborn child's heart has begun to beat. Women deserve to know the truth about their unborn children, and their unborn children deserve life. This has been a perspective on life from National Right to Life. For more information, visit our website, www.nrlc.org.
It's the new phone number for the Issues Etc. listener comment line, 618-223-8384. Leery about calling a live radio talk show? Want to remain anonymous? Leave your recorded question or comment on the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8384. The good, the bad, the ugly. We're big boys. We can take it. 618-223-8384.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Monday on the program, Dr. David Menton will join us. We'll talk about creation and evolution. Tuesday, the new atheist will be our subject. Greg Kokel will be our guest. And then Wednesday, good friend Father Richard John Newhouse of First Things will join us to talk about abortion and civil rights. He has said famously that abortion is the great civil rights struggle of the 21st century. I agree. I'm sure you do, too. We'll find out more Wednesday on Issues Etc. as we talk with Father Newhouse about that. Jihad is our subject right now. Dr. Adam Francisco is our guest. He's guest professor of historical theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He has a forthcoming book Luther, and Islam. Are we really seeing in the simple attempt to define or redefine the term jihad a split in Islam itself, a division or a disagreement in Islam itself?
In a way, yes. Right now, it seems like the big question facing Muslims across the world is, what does it mean to be a Muslim? However, really, to embrace sort of modern secular or Western values, the way many Muslims are doing in the West, is really to become an apostate if you take the Quran and the traditions of Islam seriously.
The example that Muhammad gives in his life for the Muslim is of paramount importance, I believe. It might even exceed that of the Quran itself in practice.
Yes.
So let's look at Muhammad's life, the little that we do know about it, and see if we can derive from his actions and his sayings what he thought jihad must mean.
Yeah, if I can plug another book, Robert Spencer's Truth About Muhammad is a must-read on this topic. You see two periods in Muhammad's so-called prophetic ministry. In 610 A.D., he is called as a prophet, Islamic tradition tells us. From 610 to 622, he and what followers he could acquire in Mecca were for the most part persecuted, and those passages found in the Quran from that period are relatively tolerant. You get passages like Surah 29, verse 46, where Muhammad tells the Muslims that when they meet Jews and Christians, they should not argue with them, but rather tell them that we all believe in the same God. But then all of a sudden, after 622, when Muhammad and the Muslim community make their pilgrimage to Medina, or they move, they actually emigrate out of Mecca to Medina because the persecution had gotten so harsh, then all of a sudden, things change drastically, and you get passages like Quran chapter 9:5, which is known as the verse of the sword. It says, when the sacred months are over, kill the unbelievers wherever you find them. Take them captive, besiege them, and lie in wait for them at every point of observation. That passage is in every classical book or a Quranic commentary refers to that passage as the not just the verse of the sword, but the verse that abrogates all other verses on Muslim relations with non-Muslims.
No, that's important. I want you to pause there for a moment. You explain the whole doctrine of abrogation by which faithful Muslims read the Quran having to do with earlier and later passages in the Quran.
Yes, well, if anybody who's read the Quran knows that it is not set out, it does not read chronologically. It sort of reads like, in some places, like poetry, other places, just like a bunch of stories strewn together. There is no chronological unfolding in the book. And what Muslim tradition tells us is that when they put the book together, they had all these different recordings that people had taken down as Muhammad spoke under inspiration, and they decided just to put the longest chapters or chunks, to use a technical term, up front and the shorter ones towards the end. And so there's a whole discipline in Islamic studies in determining which parts from the Quran came before the others or which came afterwards. And scholars do not agree on this. So there's a lot of disagreement, in fact, but almost all, and I think maybe in fact all, agree that chapter 9 of the Quran, where you find the verse of the sword, was one of the latest so-called revelations. The later ones are, if they contradict earlier ones according to this law of abrogation, the later ones, of course, supersede the earlier ones. And what the famous example is with drinking wine. Early on in the Quran, it says you can drink wine, but just don't go inebriated into the mosque. Then at the end, it says absolutely no fermented beverages at all.
Which is why, being consistent with their hermeneutic, if you will, the way of interpreting their scriptures, they don't drink wine.
Right. Well, they're not. Some will push it and say, well, the only kind of wine they had in the Arabian Peninsula at that time was date wine. So that's really what's illegal. And so that's why you get the Saudi royal family drinking fine scotches and things. because they're not drinking date wine. So it's perfectly legal under their school of jurisprudence.
Well, this is an email from Matt in Seward, Nebraska. He says, aren't many of Muhammad's surahs about jihad spoken within the context of the war with the pagan Meccans? Is it possible that later Muslims took him out of context? I mean, just because Muhammad called for a jihad then does not mean that it could be done later. Who determines a legitimate jihad? Those are all good questions. Your response?
Yeah, very good questions. There are some Muslim scholars, contemporary Muslim scholars, who are really trying to provide what a UVA prof calls a Muslim theology for the 21st century. And he says, we've got Muslims have to get away from their tradition and go back to the Quran and reinterpret the Quran and, in fact, do just that. See it all as happening just within the 7th century and not being applicable. But the problem is that the hadith, these recorded sayings of Muhammad that weren't directly revealed to him by Allah, but instead were just things he said, and but because he was a prophet, are somewhat revelatory. Muhammad clearly says, after two men come back from a jihad up north of Medina, they say, we've gone on jihad. Now can we rest and enjoy all the booty we acquired during these wars? And Muhammad responds to them and says that the jihad remains perpetual until the day of judgment. Jihad is, and this is in most books on Islamic jurisprudence, they all, for the most part, agree that jihad shall remain until the end times.
One of the things that I think makes this a little more complicated is the fact that, and we've talked about this before on the program, that Islam, as both a religious and a quasi-political system, which it proves to be more often than not, has no distinction between mosque and state, or church and state in the Western concept.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, in answer to Matt's question, who legitimately calls for a jihad, it seems as though whoever has the most influence in the country, maybe not the leader, but maybe the highest cleric.
Yes, yeah, that's actually very perceptive. Historically, it was the caliph, the emperor, if you will, the central authority in the Muslim world that was to call jihad. And he was, according to Islamic law, to call a jihad at least once a year to keep the spirit of jihad alive. Now, in 1924, when Turkey becomes a secular state, they abolish the caliphate. And so there hasn't been a real caliph in the Muslim world for over 80 years now. And so that's the big debate in the Muslim world, is who can legitimately call jihad. And some people are referring to the internet as the cyber caliphate. You've got all these religious teachers where if you got a particular question about jihad or whether you can drink Glenfiddich scotch or not, you just type in your question online, and this cyber caliphate will give you an answer. So you're right. In a way, today, whoever has the most influence can call it jihad, it seems.
Dr. Adam Francisco is guest professor of historical theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's author of the forthcoming book, Luther and Islam. Thank you for being our guest.
Hey, it was good to be with you.
This term, this, in many ways, kind of the centerpiece of at least ancient Islam's worldview, jihad, struggle, warfare, it should concern us. It should also concern us that those who lead us, be they our religious leaders or our political leaders, fail to understand what it means. We should be calling earnestly to Muslims in the Western world to define these terms for us, for they're important not only to them personally as the religious terms, but to the rest of us who need to live together in peaceful democracies. Is it possible? Time will tell. If jihad means what it seems to mean from the Quran, from Islamic history, and from many Muslims in the world today, peace may not be an option in Islam. Most certainly cannot be seen as a religion of peace. Monday on Issues, Etc., Dr. David Menton will join us. We'll talk about creation and evolution. Tuesday, the new atheist, Greg Kokel, will be our guest, and Father Richard John Newhouse will be with us Wednesday next week to talk about abortion and civil rights. What is the religion of peace? That answer is simple. The one who brings peace, the only one who can bring peace, is not the person who stands at the top of the pile at the end of the day and declares warfare over. It is the one who hangs on the cross, having paid the price for the sins of the world, none other than Jesus Christ. There is true peace. In spite of warfare and struggle in this world, there is the only true peace, peace with God. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 1046, San Juan Capistrano, California, 92693. Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.